Chapter 5. Love. Exhibit F. High look of love as power to calm the stormiest passion of my soul. But without doubt, as he had been reserving her looks of love a good part of the time for 10 months, now ever since he began to lavish his own on Cornelia Turner at the end of the previous July. He does really seem to have already forgotten Cornelia's merits in one brief month, for he eulogizes Harriet in a way which rules all competition out. Who only virtuous, gentle, kind, amid a world of hate? He complains of her hardness, and begs her to make the concession of a light endurance of his waywardness, perhaps for the sake of a fellow being's lasting weal. But the main force of his appeal is in his closing stanza, and is strongly worded. Tract for once knowing guide. Bid the remorseless feeling flee. 'Tis malice, 'tis revenge, 'tis pride, 'tis anything but thee. I deign a nobler pride to prove, and pity if thou canst not love. This is in May, apparently towards the end of it. Harriet and Shelley were corresponding all the time. Harriet got the poem, a copy exists in her own handwriting, she being the only gentle and kind person amid a world of hate. According to Shelley's own testimony in the poem, we are permitted to think that the daily letters would presently have melted that kind and gentle heart and brought about the reconciliation, if there had been time, but there wasn't. For in a very few days, in fact, before the 8th of June, Shelley was in love with another woman. And so, perhaps, while Harriet was walking the floor nights, trying to get her poem by heart, her husband, and was doing a fresh one for the other girl, Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin, with sentiments like these in it. Exhibit G, to spend years thus and be rewarded, as thou, sweet love, requited me when none were near. Thy lips did meet mine tremblingly. Comma, gentle and good and mild thou art, nor can I live, if thou appear aught but thyself. And so on. Ever the close of June it was known, and felt by Mary and Shelley, that each was inexpressibly dear to the other. Yes, Shelley had found this child of 16 to his liking, and had wooed and won her in the graveyard. But that is nothing. It was better than wooing her in her nursery, at any rate, where it might have disturbed the other children. However, she was a child in years only. From the day that she set her masculine grip on Shelley, he was to frisk no more. If as he had occupied the only kind and gentle Harriet's place in March, it would have been a thrilling spectacle to see her invade the Boinville Rookery and read the riot act. That holiday of Shelley's would have been of short duration, and Cornelia's hair would have been as gray as her mother's when the services were over. Hogg went to the Godwin residence in Skinner Street with Shelley on that 8th of June. They passed through Godwin's little debt factory of a book dash shop, and went upstairs hunting for the proprietor. Nobody there. Shelley strode about the room impatiently, making its crazy floor quake under him. Then a door is partially and softly opened. A thrilling voice called Shelley. A thrilling voice answered, Mary. And he darted out of the room like an arrow from the bow of the far-shooting king. A very young female, fair and fair-haired, pale, indeed, and with a piercing look, wearing a frock of tartan, an unusual dress in London at that time, had called him out of the room. This is Mary Godwin, as described by Hogg. The thrill of the voices shows that the love of Shelley and Mary was already upward of a fortnight old. Therefore it had been born within the month of May, born while Harriet was still trying to get her poem by heart, we think. I must not be asked how I know so much about that thrill. It is my secret. The biographer and I have private ways of finding out things when it is necessary to find them out, and the customary methods fail. Shelley left London that day, and was gone 10 days. The biographer conjectures that he spent this interval with Harriet in Bath. It would be just like him. To the end of his days he liked to be in love with two women at once. He was more in love with Miss Hitchener when he married Harriet than he was with Harriet, and told the lady so with simple and unostentatious candor. He was more in love with Cornelia than he was with Harriet in the end of 1813, and the beginning of 1814, yet he supplied both of them with love poems of an equal temperature meantime. He loved Mary and Harriet in June, and while getting ready to run off with the one, it is conjectured that he put in his odd time trying to get reconciled to the other. By and by, while still in love with Mary, he will make love to her half-sister by marriage, adoption, and the visitation of God, through the medium of clandestine letters, and she will answer with letters that are for no eye but his own. When Shelley encountered Mary Godwin, he was looking around for another paradise. He had tastes of his own, and there were features about the Godwin establishment that strongly recommended it. Godwin was an advanced thinker and an able writer. One of his romances is still read, but his philosophical works, once so esteemed, are out of vogue now. Their authority was already declining when Shelley made his acquaintance, that is, it was declining with the public, but not with Shelley. They had been his moral and political Bible, and they were that yet. Shelley the infidel would himself have claimed to be less a work of God than a work of Godwin. Godwin's philosophies had formed his mind, and interwoven themselves into it, and become a part of its texture. He regarded himself as Godwin's spiritual son. Godwin was not without self-appreciation. Indeed, it may be conjectured that from his point of view the last syllable of his name was surplusage. He lived serene in his lofty world of philosophy, far above the mean interests that absorbed smaller men, and only came down to the ground at intervals, to pass the hat for alms, to pay his debts with, and insult the man that relieved him. Several of his principles were out of the ordinary. For example, he was opposed to marriage. He was not aware that his preachings from this text were but theory and wind. He supposed he was in earnest in imploring people to live together without marrying, until Shelley furnished him a working model of his scheme, and a practical example to analyze. By applying the principle in his own family, the matter took a different and surprising aspect then. The late Matthew Arnold said that the main defect in Shelley's makeup was that he was destitute of the sense of humor. This episode must have escaped Mr. Arnold's attention. But we have said enough about the head of the new paradise. Mrs. Godwin is described as being in several ways a terror, and even when her soul was in repose she wore green spectacles. But I suspect that her main unattractiveness was born of the fact that she wrote the letters that are out in the appendix basket in the backyard, letters which are an outrage and wholly untrustworthy, for they say some kind things about poor Harriet, and tell some disagreeable truths about her husband, and these things make the fabulous critic's teeth a good deal. Next we have Fanny Godwin, a Godwin by courtesy only. She was Mrs. Godwin's natural daughter by a former friend. She was a sweet and winning girl, but she presently wearied of the Godwin paradise, and poisoned herself. Last in the list is Jane, or Claire, as she preferred to call herself, Claremont, daughter of Mrs. Godwin by a former marriage. She was very young and pretty and accommodating, and always ready to do what she could to make things pleasant. After Shelley ran off with her part-sister Mary, she became the guest of the pair, and contributed a natural child to their nursery, Allegra. Lord Byron was the father. We have named the several members and advantages of the new paradise in Skinner Street, with its crazy bookshop underneath. Shelley was all right now, this was a better place than the other, more variety anyway, and more different kinds of fragrance. One could turn out poetry here without any trouble at all. The way the new love match came about was this. Shelley told Mary all his aggravations and sorrows and griefs, and about the wet nurse and the bonnet shop, and the surgeon and the carriage, and the sister-in-law that blocked the London game, and about Cornelia and her mama, and how they had turned him out of the house after making so much of him, and how he had deserted Harriet, and then Harriet had deserted him, and how the reconciliation was working along, and Harriet getting her poem by heart, and still he was not happy, and Mary pitied him, for as he had trouble herself. But I am not satisfied with this. It reads too much like statistics. It lacks smoothness and grace, and is too earthy and businesslike. It has the sordid look of a trades union procession out on strike. That is not the right form for it. The book does it better. We will fall back on the book, and have a cakewalk. T was easy to divine that some restless grief possessed him. Mary herself was not unlearned in the lore of pain. His generous zeal in her father's behalf, his spiritual sonship to Godwin, his reverence for her mother's memory, were guarantees with Mary of his excellence. What she was after was guarantees of his excellence. That he stood ready to desert his wife and child was one of them, apparently. The new friends could not lack subjects of discourse, and underneath their words about Mary's mother, and political justice, apostrophe and rights of woman, apostrophe were two young hearts, each feeling towards the other, each perhaps unaware, trembling in the direction of the other. The desire to assuage the suffering of one whose happiness has grown precious to us may become a hunger of the spirit as keen as any other, and this hunger now possessed Mary's heart. When her eyes rested unseen on Shelley, it was with a look full of the ardor of a soothing pity. Apostrophe, yes, that is better, and has more composure. That is just the way it happened. He told her about the wet nurse, she told him about political justice, he told her about the deadly sister-in-law, she told him about her mother, he told her about the bonnet shop, she murmured back about the rights of woman. Then he assuaged her, then she assuaged him, then he assuaged her some more, next she assuaged him some more, then they both assuaged one another simultaneously. And so they went on by the hour assuaging and assuaging and assuaging, until at last what was the result? They were in love. It will happen so every time. He had married a woman who, as he now persuaded himself, had never truly loved him, who loved only his fortune and his rank, and who proved her selfishness by deserting him in his misery. I think that is not quite fair to Harriet. We have no certainty that she knew Cornelia had turned him out of the house. He went back to Cornelia, and Harriet may have supposed that he was as happy with her as ever. Still, it was judicious to begin to lay on the whitewash, for Shelley is going to need many a coat of it now, and the sooner the reader becomes used to the intrusion of the brush the sooner he will get reconciled to it, and stop fretting about it. After Shelley's conjectured visit to Harriet at Bath 8th of June to 18th, T seems to have been arranged that Shelley should henceforth join the Skinner Street household each day at dinner. Nothing could be handier than this. Things will swim along now. Though now Shelley was coming to believe that his wedded union with Harriet was a thing of the past, he had not ceased to regard her with affectionate consideration. He wrote to her frequently, and kept her informed of his whereabouts. We must not get impatient over these curious inharmoniousnesses and irreconcilabilities in Shelley's character. You can see by the biographer's attitude towards them that there is nothing objectionable about them. Shelley was doing his best to make two adoring young creatures happy. He was regarding the one with affectionate consideration by mail, and he was assuaging the other one at home. Nappy Harriet, residing at Bath, had perhaps never desired that the breach between herself and her husband should be irreparable and complete. I find no fault with that sentence, except that the perhaps is not strictly warranted. It should have been left out. In support or shall we say extenuation? Of this opinion I submit that there is not sufficient evidence to warrant the uncertainty which it implies. The only evidence offered that Harriet was hard and proud, and standing out against a reconciliation, is a poem, the poem in which Shelley beseeches her to it the remorseless feeling flee, and idy if she added love. We have just that as evidence, and out of its meager materials the biographer builds a cobhouse of conjectures as big as the Colosseum. Conjectures which convince him, the prosecuting attorney, but ought to fall far short of convincing any fair-minded jury. Shelley's love poems may be very good evidence, but we know well that they are out for this day and train only. We are able to believe that they spoke the truth for that one day, but we know by experience that they could not be depended on to speak it the next. The very supplication for a rewarming of Harriet's chilled love was followed so suddenly by the poet's plunge into an adoring passion for Mary Godwin, that if it had been a check it would have lost its value before a lazy person could have gotten to the bank with it. Hardness, stubbornness, pride, vindictiveness, these may sometimes reside in a young wife and mother of 19. But they are not charged against Harriet Shelley outside of that poem, and one has no right to insert them into her character on such shadowy evidence as that. Peacock knew Harriet well, and as he has a flexible and persuadable look, as painted by him. Her manners were good, and her whole aspect and demeanor such manifest emanations of pure and truthful nature that to be once in her company was to know her thoroughly. She was fond of her husband, and accommodated herself in every way to his tastes. If they mixed in society, she adorned it. If they lived in retirement, she was satisfied. If they traveled, she enjoyed the change of scene. Perhaps as he had never desired that the breach should be irreparable and complete. The truth is, we do not even know that there was any breach at all at this time. We know that the husband and wife went before the altar, and took a new oath on the 24th of March to love and cherish each other until death, and this may be regarded as a sort of reconciliation itself, and a wiping out of the old grudges. Then Harriet went away, and the sister-in-law removed herself from her society. That was in April. Shelley wrote his appeal in May, but the corresponding went right along afterwards. We have a right to doubt that the subject of it was a reconciliation, or that Harriet had any suspicion that she needed to be reconciled, and that her husband was trying to persuade her to it as the biographer has sought to make us believe, with his coliseum of conjectures built out of a wastebasket of poetry. For we have evidence now, not poetry and conjecture. When Shelley had been dining daily in the Skinner Street Paradise 15 days, and continuing the love match which was already a fortnight old 25 days earlier, he forgot to write Harriet, forgot it the next day and the next. During 4 days Harriet got no letter from him. Then her fright and anxiety rose to expression heat, and she wrote a letter to Shelley's publisher which seems to reveal to us that Shelley's letters to her had been the customary affectionate letters of husband to wife, and had carried no appeals for reconciliation, and had not needed to. At postmark July 7, 1814. Why, dear sir, you will greatly oblige me by giving the enclosed to Mr. Shelley. I would not trouble you, but it is now 4 days since I have heard from him, which to me is an age. Will you write by return of post, and tell me what has become of him? As I always fancy something dreadful has happened, if I do not hear from him. If you tell me that he is well, I shall not come to London, but if I do not hear from you or him, I shall certainly come, as I cannot endure this dreadful Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.